Talking with George McPhitty on 30th August 76 at Grenoble. Now, if you could just very briefly, before we come to when you came in touch with radio astronomy, tell me about your background beforehand. That will set the scene more or less.
My background, you mean before my
the
job?
The mid-50s. I mean, you were trained as a...
I was trained as an applied mathematician in the English sense of that term, which has no exact American counterpart. It's a cross between a theoretical physicist and a man who is interested in the theoretical foundations of engineering science.
I see.
And I was always interested in relativity theory, and I had decided that you cannot get anywhere in relativity theory and cosmology except by close contact with observations. There were too many possible theoretical frameworks. And therefore, eventually, I came to the United States because I was nearer the observers than I could be in England.
Why was that, if I may ask?
Simply because the Earth is round, and it's easier to see Alan Sandage if you're in Urbana than it is if you're
I'm
in
sorry,
London. The optical boys.
Okay, I'm sorry, I was thinking of radio.
Well, yes. Of course, the radio had not
What year was this when you came to America?
1952.
Yes.
Certainly radio astronomy had begun in England, but I was not at that time interested in it or knew much about it.
Right.
But when I came to Illinois after about a year or a couple of years, the head of the electrical engineering department, Ed Jordan, told me that I ought, you know, to take an interest in this new science of radio astronomy.
I see.
And as he knew that the atmospherics of the Middle West were not very good for optical telescopes, he said, why don't you look into this radio astronomy business? In fact, says he, there's going to be a meeting in Washington, and I will get the Dean of Engineering, though I was in liberal arts, to put up the money. You should go. Which I did, and there I met people like Bach and so on, who were interested in developing the thing at Harvard.
What was your impression? This was 1954, I think, this meeting.
Yes, about then.
And what was your impression of the state of the field at that time?
Well, the impression was that they were very unwilling, the optical astronomers, to plunge into this, or not unwilling, but very cautious, into this unknown field. Very sensibly, in some ways, they said, we are, as it were, leaders in optical astronomy. We have the climate and the instruments. We need quite a considerable persuading to embark on this new field, which seemed sensible enough to me. But, of course, there were people like myself who were located in parts of the United States where the seeing is not good, the Middle West. And so we rather chipped in and said, true, what you say, but here is a chance for institutions that are not in the best part of the United States mm-hmm. to, from the optical point of view, to do something. And so it was agreed that we should begin looking into this question.
Was there anyone, especially of the optical astronomers, questioning the entire value of radio astronomy? It was only a matter of, well, it's valuable, but it's not something for us to be doing. Were the people saying, well, it shouldn't really be funded much at all?
I can't remember anyone taking as extreme a view as that. But I think in the minds of some of the people was that we should not, in the United States, spread our interest too much. And this is very sensible. You've got to be sure that it's going to give something before you embark.
Yeah, sure.
But anyway, Bach, of course, Harvard was taking lead at that time.
Right.
I can't remember who else was there.
Well, NRL had a strong program with their big dish.
1954?
Yes. Dish had been around for a year or two by then.
Oh, yes.
And so it must they'd been doing solar eclipse work and so forth before then. Cornell had a small program.
Yes, that's right.
But the Harvard was the most astronomically oriented program connected with the university department. That was about it.
So then I came back to Illinois and reported all this to Ed Jordan. And he said, look, this looks hopeful. I think you should not lose interest. And I agreed with him that it did look hopeful. The kind of thing that we could do at Illinois, we hoped. And the next step there was to appoint George Swenson, partly as in electrical engineering and partly with me in the astronomy department. Mm-hmm. And then I remember I got money out of, I think it was out of the university, to send him around the world looking at various types of instruments. And what we tried to do, of course, was to build a cheap instrument, cheap in the sense of not having to spend very much money at the beginning, but we realized it would require more upkeep than a more expensive instrument.
Right.
Which was chiefly to be used for the purpose of making a survey of the sky at 600 and, well, whatever channel 37 is on the 604,
UHF,
I think it is. I forget now.
And now, when did you sort of make this decision that this is what you want to do?
Oh, around about 1957-58.
And what was the context of this? I mean, there were surveys at that time, of course. The 2C survey had been published. The 3C was in progress about that time.
Yes, and they were being done at other frequencies, though. And we picked this one because nobody was doing a survey at it. We had an idea that you ought to get the spectral index, and that the more surveys there were at different frequencies, the better.
Right. Were you thinking that you might pick up a new class of source at the higher frequency?
No, not so much a new class of source, simply to make another survey, because you remember they were the 58 mills in
right.
Australia, and Ryle were beginning to quarrel furiously over the log N, log S.
Right.
And that was the reason why I did this thing, because
The Australian Journal of Physics 57
yes.
paper, right.
Because it seemed to me that they were arguing on the wrong lines. They were arguing whether log N, log S should be connected by, I think it's log N equal minus 3/2 log S. That minus 3/2 was a magic number, because this meant that the sources were uniformly distributed in space.
Right.
Now, this was a resuscitation of the arguments I'd had in the 1930s with Hubble and the optical astronomers, who also had a prejudice in favor of that particular formula. The notion that uniformity in space could mean instantaneous uniformity.
I see what you're saying.
From instantaneous at each instant, but different from one instant to another, took a long time to sink into the minds of the optical astronomers. And here, to my horror, in the late 1950s, 20 years later, one seemed to be having to start the same argument again with the radio astronomers.
Right. So, that's very interesting.
So I remember the, for instance, the furious quarrels at the IAU in 1961 between Mills and Ryle, and
at the Paris Symposium in 58, were you?
That wasn't so bad. 1961 was the worst. My wife was there with me, and there were weeping wives of the radio astronomers weeping on my wife's shoulder about how their husbands were being abused, and I won't give names,
right.
But Mildred, my wife, who's no astronomer, was astounded.
Yes, yes.
Well, anyway,
I'm a little, let me just pursue, I'm a little surprised that it was worse in 61, because I thought by then that things had become resolved, the Cambridge people had agreed that 2C was a bad mistake, but 3C was all right, and what was the real nature of the argument at that stage?
Simply the rule for distribution of log N and log S, that was one of the arguments.
Cambridge still had a steeper slope, but it was nowhere near as steep as the original.
It was this business of the slope, the steepness,
yeah.
and so on. And what this paper tried to do was to show, it was one of the earlier ones that showed, that if you suppose that the radio sources, the extragalactic sources, partook of the general motion of expansion, you would not expect to get anything like a simpler rule as log n proportional to a constant times log s, let alone 3/2.
Right, right.
17/23 or right. Any nonsensical number. The relationship was far more complicated. And even as early as 1957, it became apparent to me that nothing would fit unless you allowed either these radio sources to be on the average much more intense in the past or to be much more numerous.
Well, now, of course, this is the crux of what Ryle and Scheuer were saying at that time. Now, one may say that they were saying it on the wrong basis, but yeah. They were arguing strongly for this, that it had to be an evolving universe. They also said.
But I don't know what they... you better be careful as to what they mean by evolving universe.
Well, the perfect cosmological principle was not satisfied. That's what they were trying to get after, I think.
The term evolving universe is so ambiguous. To some people, it simply means using a Friedman model in which there is expansion. That is to say, what I call instantaneous uniformity. To others, it simply means even a statical universe where nothing is expanding, but in which the individual objects evolve.
That's not what I mean. I mean that the universe itself is evolving in its properties, not that the sources themselves.
Because you can. But what I was arguing here was that the individual sources were evolving, and that you had to allow for that kind of thing if you were to fit them into a generally expanding universe. And it seems to me, looking at the literature since, that most people who work on the log n, log s have come to that opinion too. Rowan Robinson, a student of mine like Bob Rader, even in the early 1960s and so on, that you have to take account of the properties of the individual, the changes of the properties of the individual sources, if you are to fit them in at all.
Right.
And that therefore the problem is no longer one which tells you anything about the model universe, say the general expansion. What one is studying are the properties of these strange objects. And I'm afraid that is why I have rather lost interest.
Yeah.
But I'm no physicist.
There still seems to be this confusion today, I mean, as to whether you can get cosmological information out of log n, log s. There was a whole meeting in Cambridge last week.
I know.
About this. And
I was to go to that, but then I retired as gracefully as possible because I began to suspect when I saw the final program that this, I might get involved in arguments. And damn it, I'm an old man now. Let them fight it out.
It really wasn't as bad as many people thought of it. There were very few disagreements.
There were very few.
Really quite smooth. But let me still go back to this point. I want to make sure I have this right. You said that I think that the implication was that in the distant sources, they had to either be more numerous or more luminous.
No, more luminous, or a mixture of the two.
Right, which is what Ryle and Scheuer were saying. Mm. Now, to my mind, I'm not a cosmologist, but to my mind, this does mean that the steady state principle is violated. Now, is this right?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Steady state principle was violated by the optical results of Sandage in 1956. The only thing that kept the steady-state theory alive, in my opinion, even to this day, is the extraordinary genius that Fred Hoyle has for talking to journalists. He just knows exactly how to talk to these boys. And the reason why he was so successful in 1948 with the lectures on the BBC that really made his reputation as a scientist was that... he spoke as if everything he said he believed in to the depth of his soul, and this came over marvelously over the BBC. Mm-hmm. He also has the capacity of putting things in simple terms. And nobody, the general public, knows that, I was going to say 3 years later, but 3 months later, he would have uttered the very opposite of what he'd said in the same tone of absolute conviction.
Yeah, yeah.
he's an extraordinary bird, is our Fred. Well, anyway, we're not here to discuss Fred Hoyle.
Well, but I mean, he is a central character in this because, of course, there were a lot of arguments between Ryle and Hoyle at this stage about this, and not just Mills and Ryle. Now, I'm just curious, though, you say that Sandage's results, I mean, were there similar strong arguments between Hoyle and Sandage at this time?
No.
If they were as strong in evidence against steady-state theory, why wasn't Hoyle attacking these results also?
Because Hoyle, I think, well, one must not attribute, but I've heard repeatedly by the supporters of the steady-state theory that any class of observations such as Sandage's on the Hubble diagram, which does not agree with the steady-state theory, there must be something wrong with the observations.
Right.
This was the...
But this is what he said also for the radio.
Yes. This is the standard defense which has been made for 20 years, 25 years of the steady-state theory.
But what I'm trying to get at is I'm not aware, maybe it's just because I'm more radio-oriented, that Hoyle was saying this as strongly about Sandage's observations
but
as he was about
Ryle's.
He never
mentioned them about the optical things. It was people like me who were pointing out that the even the early business of... when did I write the first edition of my book? Somewhere in the middle 1950s, and Sandage had given me his very early observations on the apparent magnitudes of brightest members of clusters against redshift. And even then, you'll find the kind of thing in that.
In the Handbook to Physique article.
You see, right. August 1956. I had a lot of discussions with, and with other...
That was a mimeo version that, at the University of Illinois that came out in 56. The Handbook itself came out in 59, right?
59, that's right. It was a thing there. Anyway, you'll see the kind of things. And also in the first edition of my book, do you have General Relativity and Cosmology? Look up, if you have the first edition.
I'm not sure which edition.
1956.
I did buy it in a second-hand bookstore, so it might be the first edition.
Yes.
Right.
And, or in the second. You'll find the early interpretations. And it seemed to me then that this provided evidence against the steady-state theory because it didn't fit with Q naught. Mm. They don't fit with Q naught equal to minus one, which is necessary.
Yeah.
So...
Well, that's very interesting comments. Now, would you also agree, it seems to me that as observations have come along, the microwave background and the lack of the strongest sources in the 3C survey, that Hoyle has continually sort of patched up the steady-state theory.
This seems to be the case,
right. Yes. I mean, do you think that's a fair statement to make sort of a rear-guard action to keep on...
I should have put it like that myself, but then I've always been prejudiced against steady-state theory.
Okay. You were at the... I'm still... don't quite understand why the controversy between Ryle and Mills was, in your opinion, even more bitter in 61 than 58. I would have thought that in 58 things were at more of a height.
Let's see, was Ryle at the Paris Symposium
in
58?
Yes,
and was Mills?
Yes, they were both there. And there were bitter exchanges there. Were you at that session?
Yes, I was, but I don't remember. But I do remember the fights in 61. This had been a running fight, I imagine, for 3 years.
Oh, yes.
By the end of the 3 years, they were so, I suppose, anger against each other that they may indeed not have been arguing about the same points that they were in 58, but they were fighting because they had developed an enmity.
And by this time, did you think that there was...
In 1961, I was still hopeful that surveys like the one we were going to make, and indeed we made a portion of it before the ONR cut off our money and the instrument was ruined because it required quite a bit of upkeep every year, and when the ONR suddenly cut off the money 1 year, we took a chance on the not making the repairs in the summer in question, but leaving it to the next year. and by that time it was too much damage to be repairable without really reconstructing it from scratch, and we didn't have the money for that.
Which year was that? Just
somewhere about, that's a good question. Middle 1960s, I suppose.
Yeah, I have talked to George Svensson.
You have talked.
He's given me information.
And anyway, you'll find it in my reports in the Astronomical Journal.
Right, right.
The annual reports.
But anyway, you were saying that you in 61 you still had hope that...
Yes, in 61 the instrument was about finished and was going to start, and did in fact start around about 62, observing and program. Went ahead at least as far as collecting the data, but of course the problem from my point of view was that the moment the instrument was working, George Svensson disappeared.
Where did he go?
Leave of absence, one after another.
Oh, I see.
To go and work, and so suddenly I hadn't appreciated that in those days that there are two kinds of people interested in radio astronomy. There's the kind like Ryle, who is a great gadgeteer to build instruments, and also is interested, deeply interested, in using them for astronomical purposes. There is another type, of whom George Svensson is a very striking example, who is intensely interested in building the instruments, but hasn't the slightest interest in using them.
Yeah. No, I would agree with that. I know many examples of both kinds
myself. And I think Sir Bernard Lovell is an example of the second class.
Yeah.
And so the instrument, didn't do what it might have done, and it took an awfully long time for... See, I was department head. I couldn't sit down and do the measure, the reductions myself.
Yeah. Let me ask you also, as sort of an outsider to these whole radio source surveys in the late 50s, did you find it extremely discouraging that here you had two competent people making surveys and yet there was virtually zero correlation between them? And what were you to believe?
Oh, no. I suppose at the back of my mind, the reason for making another survey at a frequency they were not using was a hope that we might arrive at a solution.
But it's possible to think that you might have just lost faith and said, well, look, these radio techniques are just not reliable. This is not the way to go about doing things. Why did you have faith that this could be done properly?
That's a good question. I couldn't tell you, except that I've always thought that however bad observations are, however inaccurate, and however whatever differences there may be between one observer and another, one cannot get anywhere without observations, and therefore it was necessary to use them for this, whatever their defects were.
Mm-hmm.
This was my personal feeling.
Yeah.
And has always been my feeling. And that's why Mlle Mavridis in her book describes me as the... uses a strange French word. But what she means is a dyed-in-the-blue empiricist, which is very strange for a theoretician.
That's right. That's
I recognize that it is strange, but I can't help it.
Yeah.
As a theoretician, I see so many theoretical possibilities that you could spend your life inventing theoretical universes.
Right, but a lot of people just like to do that, of course.
Well, it seemed to me from my earliest days, it was really my experience with my PhD thesis in the days when Einstein used to turn out a new unified field theory of gravitational electricity. Eddington put me to work out particular cases in one of these theories, which I did in the late 1920s, and then we came to the conclusion, well, this is no better than his original general relativity. But it was not obvious until you had worked out the particular cases. So I said to myself, as a young fellow, every time one of these theories comes along, one's got to work out particular cases. Now, how is one to test the particular case? What is... There are an infinity of particular cases.
Right.
And the only thing I could see was observations, however poor and controversial they were. So all I saw, I'm afraid, in log N, log S, was another set of observational data.
Well, that's very interesting.
But when they became so complicated as they are today, when you've got to take account of the physics of individual sources and their lifetimes and so on, I said to myself, well, that's for the young. I'm too old to start again.
Okay, maybe I can close by asking you, what do you think has been the contribution that radio astronomy has made to astronomy, especially up through the early 60s? But if you want to go beyond, that's all right, too.
Oh, for heaven's sake, man, it has revealed, for example, quasars would never have been discovered, I think, without radio astronomy. Pulsars would never have been discovered. Therefore, here are two types of object which are of extraordinary interest in themselves, which we were totally unaware until radio astronomy came along. The negative result, if you like, that the problem of the solution of the nature of the model of the universe problem has been made much more complicated by the advent of radio astronomy, but I don't regard that as a defect. I regard it as a advantage to show optimistic chaps like, I think Alan Sandage started off 25 years ago with the idea that in his lifetime he would solve the problem of the universe. It is now obvious that the solution is not as simple, and radio astronomy has been largely responsible for it.
Yeah, that's right.
So?
So although it has not come to a specific solution, it certainly has suggested that the whole philosophical basis.
Set the whole problem into a much more elaborate context. Far more things must be taken into account, and if the problem of the nature of the universe is solved 300 years from now in the way that the problem of the solar system has been solved. I'm thinking now of being Galileo or even Newton. 300 years later, we know what the solar system, how it operates at least. Well, if in 300 years from now we know how the universe operates, that'll be something.
Right. What about the microwave background? How does that fit in?
That fits in too. That's an additional complication, if you like, but an additional aspect of the whole.
But is it as ambiguous as the source counts and so forth, do you think?
Oh, no. No. Because to my mind, theoretically, it is that one has to now look upon what I call two fluid models. One fluid, in inverted commas, of course, being the microwave background, and the other fluid being matter. So, it is simply an interesting additional complication which radio astronomy has brought in.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Well,
that ends the interview with George McVitie on 30th August 76.